From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is out this week. I'm Bob Garfield. Former Trump campaign aide Sam Nunberg's temporary decision earlier this week to ignore a subpoena from the special counsel instantly spun out of control on live TV. An ill-advised legal decision became an all-day spectacle fit for the Times.
Are you worried about getting arrested?
I think it would be funny if they arrested me.
You're held in contempt.
I think it would be really granted Donald Trump caused this because he's an idiot. Because he decided to give an interview to Lester Holt the day after he fired James Comey.
I'm talking to you. Yeah. I have smelled alcohol in your breath.
Well, I have not had a drink.
As cable news McNuggets go, this one was dipped in habanero ranch. But look, a turning point it was not. Special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into possible campaign and election criminality has offered periodic spasms of intrigue, a raid here, a subpoena there, an indictment, a guilty plea, but the timetable and endgame remain as mysterious as ever. Countless attempts to extrapolate Mueller's path based on those few juicy events have yielded little more than guesswork. Marcy Wheeler is an independent investigative reporter who actually makes a living decoding the behavior of prosecutors and spies. She says the biggest problem is journalists' inability to differentiate between the telling and the routine.
A lot of the reporters covering this are politics reporters and not legal reporters, and so they may not necessarily understand the impact of what serving a subpoena is on somebody, as we learned Monday with Sam Nunberg.
If you're reporting on someone preparing chicken Kiev and the butter is added, do you do a breaking news alert? Butter has been added to the chicken Kiev. Of course, it's in the recipe. It's a big part of the recipe. Duh, it's going to be added. Is it worth even noting?
Sometimes this stuff does matter. Right. Sometimes the fact that Sam Nunberg got a subpoena to testify before the grand jury, including all of the documents he has relating to 10 people, that includes Steve Bannon. Well, up until now, Steve Bannon has sort of said, I wasn't involved in this Russian thing at all. And adding his name to that subpoena, I think, is interesting. So there are things that we can read from these tea leaves, but they often get blown out of proportion. And really importantly, they often get treated as a big deal. You know, when people in power get investigated using these very powerful tools that prosecutors have, all of a sudden it looks like gross injustice when it's what happens out there in the street every day all across America.
I'm old enough to remember Kremlinology, when the press and the State Department even were reduced to interpreting the inner politics of the Soviet Union based on who was sitting where on the May Day reviewing stand or who had a speech slot at the Supreme Soviet. It was not an exact science, I think we can agree. I wonder if Muellerology is any more useful.
Robert Mueller is asking witnesses whether Donald Trump knew about the hack of the DNC before the public did.
New reporting from the Washington Post about the Mueller investigation, taking a look at the time last summer when President Trump seemed close to firing Jeff Sessions.
Tonight, NBC News reports that Robert Mueller is planning to charge Russians for hacking the DNC.
Keep in mind, what we are reading usually is what witnesses want to tell us, including Sam Nunberg's circus on Monday. That's what he decided to tell us. You need to separate what we're actually getting from Mueller. And Mueller and Rod Rosenstein and Christopher Wray, all of the people in charge of this investigation, have been very clear. In the wake of Jim Comey's improper discussion about why Hillary was not charged in July of 2016, they're only going to speak in indictments or other documents. They're not going to leak, but we can look at the documents they are presenting as an official statement about where they're going, because they've told us as much.
There was a bit on Saturday Night Live in January. Kate McKinnon was on Weekend Update, sort of playing Robert Mueller.
So then I take it you have hard evidence.
Colin, come on. You're putting me in a weird position here. I cannot comment on that, but yeah, big time. I just, oh man. Can I tell him? I want to tell him one thing. Okay. I shouldn't be, no. Okay, so, yeah. Don Jr., he wrote in his Venmo description, Russia, no, I can't, I can't. Oh, it hurts. Bobby, don't do this. I'm not gonna.
All right, so she was nominally being Robert Mueller, but really she was channeling what the audience wish Robert Mueller were doing. Marcy, are we addicts?
We're addicts in a way that is, I think, dangerous. There are stories that are not being covered as we obsess day in, day out for the Russian investigation. You know, even if you're opposed to Trump, there is the kind of activism that you maybe could better spend your time doing than watching the fifth Sam Nunberg interview of the day. But I also think we are getting a very distorted understanding of the criminal justice system, and that's dangerous too, because there are things that are of concern in the FISA process. We didn't learn about any of that in the entire month and a half Nunes-Schiff memo fight.
Marcy, thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
Marcy Wheeler is an independent investigative reporter. She blogs at emptywheel.net. Coming up, a strike strikes a nerve and a nostalgic chord. This is On the Media.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. This week, a blast from the past.
Teachers rallied outside the state capitol yesterday. They have shut down West Virginia's classrooms, demanding higher wages. Teacher pay in West Virginia is among the lowest in the nation. A demand to meet the governor has so far been denied.
A strike in West Virginia in 2018? It was like that 19th century message in a bottle that floated up this week on an Australian beach, a relic from a different time. Sarah Jaffe is a journalist and co-host of the Belabored podcast at Dissent Magazine. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Now, we live in a world of wealth disparity and corporate plutocrats and so-called right-to-work states, and over the last 40 or 50 years, the steady erosion of worker rights, especially for public employees. And then this erupts.
Yeah.
A wildcat strike, no less. Where did this come from?
The teachers in West Virginia are the 48th or 49th worst paid in the country. And they also don't have legal collective bargaining, which means that their unions are technically associations. They don't actually bargain with the school district on behalf of the teachers. They mostly get what they do through lobbying for legislation. So what's happened in West Virginia, like what's happened in many states, especially since the 2008 financial crisis, is that state budgets are strapped and they're taking them out on public services. Public employees are seeing wage cuts. They're seeing cuts to their health insurance. And they finally had enough. And so the interesting thing about this, of course, is, as you said, wildcat strike, that this is not something that has a formal process for, like, a contract ends and there's a strike vote, which is normally how we see teacher strikes or any other strike. This instead was teachers talking to each other and saying, we've had enough and we're going to do something about it. And that began in three of the historic coal counties, Mingo County, Logan County, Wyoming County. They first went out on strike, closed the entire school districts down in those counties, went to the Capitol, and the rest of the state thought it looked like fun and joined them.
And this actually harkens back to the very beginning of the labor movement in this country.
Oh, yeah.
It wasn't negotiated and then eventually strikes emerged.
Right.
Oh, no, no. It was the other way around.
Exactly. We got strikes for a long time. And then we got labor law and collective bargaining and things like that. Collective bargaining was always the compromise. It was the thing that was written into law starting in 1935 to end these big strikes that, particularly in places like West Virginia, were actually very violent at the time.
The teachers nominally won. They got a 5% pay raise, their first in 4 years.
Right.
But at the expense of other public spending, including
That's
Medicaid.
That's the question. The cuts are not written in stone yet. What is written in stone is a 5% pay raise for not just the teachers, not just the school employees, but every single public sector worker in the state of West Virginia, which is a lot of people. But the real question is, where's the money going to come from? And a lot of the teachers were arguing that the energy companies that extract various forms of fossil fuels from the state should pay higher taxes. So that's the next fight. That's the real question going forward. How much of a win will this turn out to be? And that we don't know.
And how much momentum there really is. I mean, on the one hand, the teachers have shown that they can surmount the right-to-work obstacles and their diminishing legal protections.
Right.
But at the same time, there's a Supreme Court case called Janus versus the Government Employees Union, which could allow non-union workers to refuse to pay the fees they've had to pay unions in exchange for the benefits that come in the union-negotiated contracts, right?
Labor law in the U.S. that started again in 1935 gave unions the right to collect a fee from the workers that they represent because it requires them to represent everyone in a bargaining unit that has voted for a union. So even the workers who don't vote for the union still get the protections, the higher wages, the better health insurance that the union bargains for. And for that, the union is entitled to some sort of fee.
The premise being that otherwise everybody could get a free ride.
Exactly.
They wouldn't join the union, but they'd be the beneficiaries of whatever the union was able to negotiate.
Right. So when you have a right-to-work law, what it does is it allows people to get all those benefits for free. It allows them to defund the union. And so what we're seeing now is this steady chipping away, right? We've seen right-to-work introduced in places like Michigan, Wisconsin, places that were the heart of the industrial economy in this country. Now the unions are being slowly gutted. And when people are already not getting raises, it can be really compelling to somebody who hasn't had a raise in 6 years to say, like, well, why are you paying union dues? The Supreme Court already made right to work the law of the land for home health care in 2014 with the Harris versus Quinn case. And so that was sort of the setup for what's probably going to happen with Janus.
Now, I dare say neither Janus nor Harris v. Quinn are top-of-mind legal battles. It didn't require Stormy Daniels to knock them off of cable news. They weren't there already. Labor has already been marginalized. What else has gone missing in an environment where journalism has kind of triaged labor reporting out of the picture?
I think there's actually a direct line from not talking about labor to talking about working people the way a lot of these Trump country articles talk about them. When you end up with reporters sort of going on safari to where the poors live and writing these stories about people who voted for Trump and talking about them as if they're some sort of incomprehensible other species, that actually comes from a press that is disconnected from working class people in their lives. And that's a really big problem. And it's not just a problem of, like, are you covering the struggles of a union to win a bargaining contract, but are you covering the lives of working people the same way we're covering the lives of celebrities or whoever it was that is suing Donald Trump or being sued by Donald Trump or whatever?
And so, West Virginia, wildcat strike, heroic teachers getting out from under heel of the man, sort of. Is there any part of you that believes that this could be an inflection point that will restore labor to the national conversation?
We're in the middle of a shift in our understanding of how people relate to the economy. When you look at something like Bernie Sanders, he wins a bunch of states, including these very same states, West Virginia, Wisconsin, Michigan, where working people are trying desperately to figure out how to fight back and often getting stomped on. And there's no doubt that when people see strikes, people go on strike. You can look at the strike frequency chart that just plunged after 1981 when Ronald Reagan broke the air traffic controllers union. Strike frequency has just dropped off. But after 2012, the Chicago teachers have been going on strike. And teachers have also been threatening to go on strike, taking strike votes, and winning right up to the minute. The week before the West Virginia teachers went on strike, the St. Paul, Minnesota teachers union took a strike vote, went up to midnight the night before their strike deadline. They would have been on the picket lines on Tuesday morning and got most of their demands met. And again, this is what we lose when we don't sort of have labor as a beat, is you don't see the context. You just see the, oh my God, the teachers are on strike in West Virginia, but you don't see the different places where things have been changing more incrementally all along.
Sarah, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sarah Jaffe is a journalist and co-host of the Belabored podcast at Dissent Magazine. Her book is called Necessary Trouble. By Wednesday, the strike was over and the teachers were back in their classrooms. But with the West Virginia Wildcat teachers' strike bringing renewed attention to Appalachia, commentators suddenly are reframing the character of the region.
Lo and behold, their solution is give all the money to corporations and we'll worry about you guys later. I love that the teachers are saying, no, you'll worry about us right the hell now. Okay, that's supposed to be the fighting spirit of West Virginia.
Which is a far cry from the conventional wisdom in the wake of the 2016 election.
If you go to West Virginia, Trump land.
Coal country is now Trump country.
The Appalachia voters chose Trump.
This time last year, we spoke with Elizabeth Catt, a writer and historian from East Tennessee, and author of What You Were Getting Wrong About Appalachia.
Yeah, so even before the election took place, these localities in West Virginia and Eastern Kentucky, coal country, were identified quite unambiguously as Trump country. Every prestige publication from The New Yorker to Vanity Fair had a profile about sort of down-and-out white voters.
In the past century, the narrative about West Virginia workers has fluctuated pretty dramatically from the anti-labor violence and exploitation of the early 1900s to the rise of big labor in the 50s to the age of Trump. And the caricature of self-defeating conservative politics among those most affected by globalism, climate change, and advancements in technology. But suddenly, this new narrative, or resurrected one, resistance. So we turn once again to Elizabeth Catt, who says that at least as far as the coverage goes, things are looking up.
The national coverage of this strike has been tremendous. I think that the national media is doing all the things that I wish they had done in 2016. They're getting into political nuances, poking holes at West Virginia and Appalachia's messy politics. They're on the ground interviewing many types of people, from service workers to teachers to old union bosses. Everyone seems to have a voice in this conversation that's happening now. Smaller progressive outlets have joined national media to kind of shape coverage. So it's been really, really fantastic. But one thing I would point out, the last time that we spoke, I think I said that the narrative of Appalachia swings like a pendulum, or we're either heroes or heretics. And last time we spoke, we were definitely the heretics. Now we're the heroes, but we still have to watch out for that balance that needs to come through the coverage of the region.
This time you're satisfied with the coverage. Does this tell us about the media's performance, or does it actually just tell us about you?
Well, I think that's a fair question. I'm obviously going to admit my bias here and say that the coverage that's coming out of West Virginia is more aligned to my personal politics. So, of course, I am inclined to be a little bit more generous, and that's totally fair to point that out. But based on conversations that I've had with people in the media surrounding the release of my book, I think there was a reckoning that happened maybe a little bit behind the scenes and among certain media outlets that the coverage of Appalachia that came out of the region in the 2016 presidential election was a little bit skewed, a little bit unfair. There was some mea culpas going around. And so I'm hopeful that this points to a broader change in the national conversations that people are willing to have about the region.
On the subject of caricatures, the data from the election and the polling data for the ensuing year shows that there is this class of white women who are still solidly in Trump's camp in Appalachia and elsewhere in the red states. And I'm wondering if that flies in the face of what's happening with the West Virginia teachers, or whether we need to simply hold two apparently opposing ideas in our head at the same time.
It's going to be really tempting to seize on a narrative that says this is the resistance, this is the political comeuppance for the Trump era. And the reality is these are Trump voters, these are Clinton voters, these are people who don't do a lot of civic engagement. All types are represented in this movement, and we can't really assign them a dominant political narrative. So I think it's good to keep in mind that we still want to bring a lot of nuance to these narratives and stories that we're going to tell about the region.
I have to say that this whole episode is giving me a sense of deja vu. Not that I was around in the 20s during the mine wars and the clashes between mine workers and the thugs employed by big coal, but because I know that is very much a formative part of West Virginia history. We just excuse the obvious metaphor, but mining a vein of West Virginia culture that never really disappeared?
I think that's fair to look at the way that history has informed the way that teachers and public workers and West Virginians in general at this moment are seeing their place in the world. They're using messaging that calls out to the history of labor struggles in the state. They're wearing red bandanas. They're giving deference to teachers from the southern coal camps, which were the hardest hit by labor struggles and coal extraction.
Red bandanas, they're iconic. Why?
Red bandanas were some of the only things that miners could purchase with their own money that wasn't a part of the company's store ecosystem. So these are the kinds of messaging that are taking place in the state and as teachers went about their strike actions. But it's important to realize that this is not only the history of the state, but also the histories of their families. And so these women who are leading the strike, 75% of teachers are women, they're recalling their grandfathers, their uncles, they're recalling their mothers and aunts who were participants in the 1990 teacher strikes as well. So absolutely, it's a vein of history that never went away, but it never went away because it's in people's families as well.
Is it ingrained in the West Virginia character? Are these simply political heirlooms, or are they just ancient grudges that are once again relevant?
What I see is really relevant to the way that all this history is connecting in regards to the strike is the tension over who keeps the state alive. And politicians and their corporate allies are going to say it's energy companies, it's the fossil fuel industry, it's coal, now it's natural gas. Workers are saying that we are the ones that keep the state alive. It's our labor, it's our bodies that keeps these politicians and these corporations in power. So that is really a tension that has not changed from the time of the mine wars to present day. Workers are still trying to do the best they can in a system that is really indulgent of corporate largesse.
We spoke about pendulums. The right to work movement happened to coincide very neatly with the Southern strategy and the gradual conversion of Dixiecrats into conservative Republicans. And those politics have spread around the country, not just in the South and in Appalachia, but to Wisconsin, for example. Do you believe that this suggests that the pendulum is going to swing beyond West Virginia to revive the labor movement and resistance against corporate America and the man?
It's fascinating to me. In 2016, we saw a narrative where the nation was terrified that something that was happening in Appalachia and West Virginia was going to leak out and contaminate the rest of the country. And of course, that was Trumpism. Now, people are quite excited for something that's happening in our region to spread beyond its borders. Igniting a wildfire is the metaphor used. So people are incredibly hopeful that we might see the rise of a new labor movement that finds a way to navigate around these really oppressive right-to-work laws. They're hoping that it spreads to other states like Oklahoma, Arizona, Kentucky are now all talking through potential strike actions. So that's where we are. And as somebody who thinks in terms of pendulums, I have enjoyed the way that the direction that it's swung now. But I am also skeptical that there's intense and cohesive set of politics behind this momentum.
So far.
So far.
Elizabeth, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Historian Elizabeth Catt is the author of What You Were Getting Wrong About Appalachia. Coming up, still more of what the coastal elites don't understand about working class America and its music. This is On the Media. Media.
This is Brooke. When you've finished listening to OTM this week, why don't you head over to the New Yorker Radio Hour? David Remnick sat down with Jerry Seinfeld, who just directed his first movie about Pop-Tarts.
Did you really like Pop-Tarts all that much growing up?
Oh, yeah.
How about now?
Still, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I love them.
That's a good breakfast for you?
I eat it after a bad show on a Wednesday night.
Listen to the New Yorker Radio Hour.
So do what Brooke says. Come join us for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. As Appalachian Elizabeth Catt told us, no story is simple, even if the stereotypes are deeply rooted. Take country music, which is all but synonymous with red state America and conservatism. But it wasn't always so. J. Lester Fader is a world correspondent for BuzzFeed News and the author of a study of country music's political roots, ranging from 1920 to 1974. Back in October, after a Las Vegas country music concert was the venue for a murderous shooting rampage, we spoke with him about the stereotypes of country music fans that so permeated the coverage. Fader explained to me how a melting pot of blues, bluegrass, and folk went through a commercial segregation process that gave us country music as we know it today.
It was really simple. It was about race. The record companies created what were called race records to sell to black people and what were then called hillbilly records to sell to white people in the South. Really, it's after World War II that Nashville emerges as a kind of capital of country music and a very tightly controlled stream from production to what then became popular. In the late 20th century, radio was king. If you didn't make it on country radio, which was controlled by a handful of very large corporations, you couldn't make it in mainstream country. And that largely remains the case today.
But not necessarily the other politics. Country music's first political marriages were not with conservatism, right? They were kind of New Dealish, which is lefty.
Well, at the time, white Southerners were Democrats. Southern politics, the politics of federal government and public assistance, had a lot of support among the white South. It was really only in the 1960s where the conservative movement used a lot of the anger and frustration over the civil rights movement to turn a lot of white Southerners against what became big government, where you had the federal government stepping in to desegregate. But that became a national phenomenon by the middle and late 60s. And some of the most violent backlashes were happening in places like Boston, where forced busing was highly controversial. And in that time, you saw a brand of white Southern conservative politics being nationalized. And the biggest force for that was Alabama Governor George Wallace, who was a segregationist Democrat who ran for president four times, both as an independent and as a Democrat, and really transformed the politics of race in America.
Let's put George Wallace in the White House. Let's let him get those touches.
He was finding audiences in places like Wisconsin and what we call the Rust Belt now. That 1968-1969 period was really transformative, both for the politics of race in America and also for the politics of country music.
We've been talking about 1968-1969, which happened to be the year when this song was released.
We don't smoke marijuana in Muskogee. We don't take our trips on LSD. We don't burn our draft cards down on Main Street. 'Cause we like living right and being free.
Merle Haggard, Okey from Muskogee. Tell me about that song.
So Haggard says that he initially wrote that song as a joke. The story that Haggard told about it is that they were on their tour bus going through Oklahoma. They were smoking weed. They went past the sign from Muskogee. Somebody said, I bet they don't smoke marijuana in Muskogee. And then they wrote the rest of the lyrics.
Like the hippies out in San Francisco do.
And when he started performing it, it got this explosive reaction. What he had written as a parody became an anthem.
The song became a sensation, and then what happened?
So he then followed that song up with a song called The Fighting Side of Me, which was a very direct attack on people protesting against the Vietnam War. And that sounds much more like it was intended to be anthemic.
They're walking on the fighting side of me, running down a way of life, our fighting men have fought and died.
That song was also very popular, and other people in the industry realized that there was a real marketing opportunity here.
The historian Diane Pecknold observes that it wasn't so much that country music moved to the right, but that the right moved toward country music.
I think that's right. The Nixon campaign in 68 did run some furtive country music advertisements. It was considered too tacky to do too publicly, but that was happening a little bit under the radar. After the election, Nixon was the first to issue a declaration in honor of country music. He was the first president to visit the Grand Ole Opry when he was trying to save his skin during the sort of the height of the Watergate scandal, trying to use it as a way of substantiating the claim that the Republican Party spoke for the heartland and Democrats did not. But there was a real hunger in a lot of parts of America for representation, and country music did offer a landscape that was talking a lot about old-fashioned values, but it wasn't uniform. And one of the most interesting examples was the Loretta Lynn song called The Pill, which was talking about the liberation that it gave for women because they had access to birth control.
All I've seen of this old world is a bed and a doctor bill. I'm tearing down your brooder house, 'cause now I've got the pill.
So there was some complexity in it, but it was one of the few places in popular culture where people who were scared of that kind of change really could gather.
After the presidential election, there was a whole lot of hand-wringing by the political class and the media about how we could have so missed this phenomenon. Looking back, you could make an argument that all anyone had to do was turn on the radio. Is country music the pulse of a nation?
Well, I think it's a hugely influential cultural sphere, you know, as much if not more so than a lot of pop music that gets a lot more attention. Whether it would have signaled Trump coming, I was not aware of a tremendous swing in country music politics leading up to that election, or really a tremendous swing in country music politics in the last 20 years. That said, it is one of, if not the most popular form of music in America on radio, and it would be a huge mistake not to pay attention to it.
Lester, thank you.
My pleasure.
Jay Lester Fader is a world correspondent for BuzzFeed News. According to historian Nadine Hubbs, we absolutely need to pay closer attention to country music, but minus the condescension that oozes from the supposedly sophisticated class. Hubbs is author of Rednecks, Queers, and Country Music, and she says that we need to understand that, first of all, just as the entire working class is not white, not all country music fans are white, or, for that matter, working class. And secondly, our generic assumptions about country betray an underlying discomfort with and misunderstanding of the actual working class in America.
It really takes the working class seriously in a way that no other major culture form in America does. Whatever comes up in ordinary life very often comes up in a country song. So a kid spilling his orange drink in his car seat all over the upholstery, that comes up in a country song.
A green traffic light turned straight to red. I hit my brakes and mumbled under my breath. His fries went a-flying and his orange drink covered his lap.
What has been happening over the past several decades is that there is an ever wider chasm between the upper middle class and the working class, where folks get educated, who they hang out with. We don't rub elbows anymore, and we may not rub elbows with working class music. Whatever its actual contours are, we keep our distance.
What else in this vast genre tells us more about its audience than people like me understand?
I could give two examples. One would be the hillbilly humanism that features in country songs one after another for 70 years. And another more challenging theme is the anti-bourgeois theme that features in a lot of country songs too. So hillbilly humanism is what really many country songs boil down to. And it's a very simple message. Nobody's better than anyone else. Hank Williams Sr. is one of the earliest sources of hillbilly humanism. So a song like Pictures from Life's Other Side.
Someone is fell by the way.
Even like I've Got Friends in Low Places.
'Cause I got friends in low places where the whiskey drowns and the beer chases my blues away.
Garth Brooks' song. It's about him being pissed off with an ex-girlfriend, it seems, and now she's marrying a fancy guy, and
He sings about how he went over and threw a wrench into the fancy wedding and then went back over to the bar and joined his friends and spent the rest of the night drinking and having fun. That song has the anti-bourgeois theme in it, that is, thumbing the nose at those who look down on us. Sometimes they're funny, sometimes they're really angry. Those are the kinds of songs that when a non-country fan would happen to hear one of those songs, they might be really offended, confirming their negative stereotypes. One of those songs is Redneck Woman, a very big hit by Gretchen Wilson in 2004. Some people look down on the entire song is just about telling off the people who look down on her and people like her. One of the things that we could hear in country music if we listened is that while we're often in denial that we have class differences, country songs every day are showing us otherwise. I mean, you know a song from the 70s like Take This Job and Shove It.
Take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more.
He's having a fantasy about telling off his supervisor, who's a superior, a kind of a middle-class person.
I'm glad you brought up Take This Job and Shove It, because the author of that song, an outlaw country artist named David Allan Coe, wrote another song, which we can't play much of here. Tell me about that song, to the extent that you can, on public radio, and explain why it's actually significant.
I think you're talking about David Allan Coe's 1978 underground track, F. Anita Bryant.
F. Anita Bryant, who the hell is she?
Anita Bryant was a 1958 runner-up in the Miss America pageant. She was a middle-of-the-road singer who had some top 40 hits. She opposed a local ordinance that would have extended some equal rights protection to what we would now call LGBTQ citizens. Only months after she first spearheaded that campaign, David Allan Coe, of all people, this outlaw country star, wrote a song, F. Anita Bryant. It was certainly nothing that was playable on country radio or any other kind of radio. And in the song, he makes it clear that he's very familiar not only with men who had sex with men in prison. He implies pretty strongly that he's familiar with it in every way. And that actually those people she calls homosexuals are a lot more diverse than she imagines. In his lyrics, he goes through a whole list. Some are yellow-bellied, but some are mean. And
some are killers, some are thieves, and some are singers, too. In fact, Anita Bryant, some act just like you.
In problems of a lot of our assumptions about who has been the hero and savior of liberal causes for the first 100 years of homosexuality from around 1870, when that label was devised, to about the 1970s, the sin of the working class was not that they were queer haters, but that they were queer lovers. It's only been since the civil rights era, when tolerance rose in importance, then the middle class became the owners of queer acceptance, and the working class sin was suddenly that they were queer haters.
Maybe at this point we should discuss a song from Merle Haggard, the very person who turned Okie from Muskogee into a sort of anthem, actually, mm-hmm. in defense of interracial marriage.
He released Okie from Muskogee in 1969, catapulted him into a level of stardom that he had not known before. He gained lots of new fans who were suburban conservatives. His fan base had previously overlapped with Dylan's fan base. You know, songs about social justice, songs about the downtrodden. After Haggard had such an enormous hit, his record company asked him, okay, what's going to be your follow-up? Merle Haggard's answer was he wanted to release Irma Jackson. It was the antithesis of Okie from Muskogee. the narrator sings to a woman he has loved since childhood and who he will love till I die, who is forbidden to him because she's black.
There's no way the world will understand that love is colorblind. That's why Irma Jackson can't be mine.
The record company said, no, Merle, we want another song that's going to appeal to the same people who are loving Okie. And the song that he did release was another song that appealed to those who didn't like hippies and didn't like Vietnam War protesters. It was called The Fighting Side of Me.
If our goal is to really understand not just country music as a genre, but its audience and a wide swath of America, what do we do?
The problem is confirmation bias. If you already hate the sound of country music, and country music is something you've learned to associate with this group of people who you think of as the phrase I coin in my book, the bigot class, the racist people, the homophobic people, the sexist people, it's a nice fantasy that takes the middle class, upper middle class off the hook, despite the fact that they actually have their hands on the levers of institutional power that could really make changes in society. To blame America's social ills on some of its least influential citizens is distortive wishful thinking. So how do we stop or slow down a stereotype? I'd be happy to share a playlist that could give you a broader picture of country music fans. But the problem would be maybe you would wince at every song.
You know, one of the sad ironies of this conversation is that there is a song that is about exactly what we're discussing. It's called They Don't Know, and it's by Jason Aldean, who was the artist performing in Las Vegas when the shots rang out.
But those folks ain't lived in our lives.
Nowadays in country music, this theme comes up again and again. It comes up with melancholy. It comes up with rage. Being judged, being misunderstood, they don't know.
Dean, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob. It's been a pleasure.
Nadine Hubbs is a professor of women's studies and music at the University of Michigan and author of Rednecks, Queers, and Country Music. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, Michael Loewinger, and Leah Fetter. We had more help from John Hanrahan, Isaac Napel, and Philip Yiannopoulos. And our show was edited this week by our executive producer, Katya Rogers. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Sam Baer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.
And I'm not quite finished. During the Oscars, the National Rifle Association sent out a stark warning to the media over its agenda to destroy American values.
We've had enough of the lies, the sanctimony, the arrogance, the hatred, the pettiness, the fake news. So to every line member of the media, to every Hollywood phony, to the role model athletes who use their free speech to alter and undermine what our flag represents.
That's a teaser for a new show on NRA TV, hosted apparently by NRA spokesreactionary Dana Lash, who kicks ass and names names.
To the Joyanne Reeds, the Morning Joes, the Mikas. To those who stain honest reporting with partisanship, to those who bring bias and propaganda to CNN, The Washington Post, and The New York Times, your time is running out.
And then she turns over an hourglass like the Explorer Magellan or the Wicked Witch of the West.
The clock starts. now.
Whoa. But the promo is so limited. What about the second We're Gonna Destroy You episode and the third? So herewith, we offer a follow-up teaser. Not because the NRA demands a response, not because the public interest is necessarily served, not because it contributes to an important conversation, just because it feels so good.
We've had enough of the dinnertime calls for free cruises, the four-hour cable repair windows, the autoplay internet ads. We are done with the hair trigger red light cameras, the persistent thigh chafing, the $8 airport hot dogs. We are done with that thing when someone leaves the checkout line to grab one item and doesn't come back for 2.5 minutes. We are done with bleeding gums. We are done with raccoons. So to every indifferent fast food cashier, to every too loud cell phone talker, to every mixer of cognac and soft drinks, you are on notice. To the Shia LaBeoufs, the Jerry Joneses, to that snooty Jennifer at Color Tile Customer Service, to all those who think you are the boss of me, we have 300 million guns, and your time is running out. The clock starts now. Do I press this twice? Okay, nothing's happening. I'm pressing it. Is that AM or PM? 1201. I'll do 1201. Okay. The clock starts now.